accuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
Today we'll discuss AFGE's TSA campaign with National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, the House of Representatives' proposed spending cap with Economic Policy Institute Federal Budget Policy Analyst Andrew Fieldhouse, and campaign finance reform with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar. First with us now is AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Jason. Glad to be back.
Now, AFGE is nearing the end of its historic TSA election. How has that gone so far?
It's going very well, Jason. It's been a long 8 years, a very long time. Just to sort of recap, if you will remember, after 9/11, AFGE led the charge that the airport screeners should be federalized. And they finally went through legislation, and once they were federalized, AFG proceeded to organize these employees. The Bush administration said, no, you can't have collective bargaining. We went out and again encouraged these employees to join AFGE and worked as an advocate for them in workplace issues. And now, finally, the Obama administration has given collective bargaining, and we are finally down to the voting process. It will end Tuesday, June 21st at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Daylight Savings Time. But I'm feeling very good about it. People nationwide are voting. The officers have been very excited. President Gage, myself, National Vice President Augusta Thomas, and all of our national vice presidents and activists have been all over the country from the largest to the smallest airports, encouraging people to vote AFGE.
Now, AFGE obviously has had a presence and has been the union for TSOs from the very beginning. What can the transportation security officers expect in these final days of the election?
They can expect us calling them continuously, going to them one-on-one, encouraging them to vote. The one concern that I have had with this entire election, Jason, is apathy. That we don't get voter participation. We don't get the high turnout of voters that we need. And it's not just in union elections. It's in national elections for President of the United States, members of Congress, local elections. People need to go and vote. The right to vote is a very, very cherished issue to me and should be to everyone in this country.
Of course, getting people out to vote is the key to any successful election. What have been AFGE's strategies to ramp up that voting process?
Certainly, the major issues that we've been out there talking about is the fact that AFGE will immediately pursue ending PASS. That's the performance evaluation system for TSOs. It is a very, very unfair system. It's very subjective. They have these tests. There are people that just simply do not test well, that perform very well, but they do not test well. And again, it's the supervisor's opinion whether I like you or do not like you. The Transportation Security Administration is under a different pay scale. AFG is firmly committed to moving these employees under the GS pay scale. This pay system frequently will give an employee a $500 one-time bonus. I believe very strongly people should get percentages of increases and those type things. I mean, if you keep just giving a one-time bonus of $500 for 20 years, the person's base pay stays the same, and you can't live on those amount of funds.
When you are out on the road and you're talking to TSOs, do you find that PASS is the number one concern that they have?
PASS is the number one concern and moving to the GS pay scale. And AFG is the only union that has committed to ending PASS and supports moving these officers to the GS pay scale. We are the only ones. There are other folks out there who you say, oh, these nice little pay systems, they're fine, and we'll go out and do X, Y, Z. Anytime there has been a deviation from the GS pay scale, it is about lowering federal employee pay. It is not about paying federal employees more money.
Talk about the history that AFGE has with taking on and defeating some of these pay-for-performance models.
We took on NSPS, which was in the Department of Defense, which the past administration had put in. It was moving full steam ahead, and it was all about, again, giving raises to management cronies and supervisors' little picks, while 99% of the employees were getting no raises, no cost of living adjustments. We took that on. We ended that. We got that voted completely out of the law, out of the regulations. AFG is the only union that has successfully fought the government and won at destroying these bad pay systems. And NSPS is dead, and it's dead because of AFGE.
If you could put your finger on one reason why AFGE is behind those types of defeats, what would it be?
There are actually two reasons: our size and the fact that we're affiliated with the AFL-CIO. We're the largest federal employee union, representing over 625,000 federal employees nationwide. We are affiliated with the AFL-CIO, which is over 12 million union members nationwide. So there is power, there is strength in numbers. And I'm very, very strongly committed to being an affiliate of the AFL-CIO. I believe you have to be in the House of Labor, that all unions have to work collectively together. That's what being a union is about.
Here on Inside Government, we've covered TSA a number of times in the past. And in addition to the past pay-for-performance system, we've also heard that morale is quite low at TSA. Could you talk about that?
It is. It's one of the lowest ranking agencies with morale. The turnover is very high. Again, the work, they have what's called split shifts, where someone may come in at 4 o'clock in the morning, work for several hours, leave, not come back to work again till 5 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. There's high numbers of part-time employees. I mean, obviously people are looking for full-time work. Even though that there is the work for full-time employees, they choose to just create more part-time positions. Because there is not a union, and because there is no interacting with employees, and employees don't have a way to seek relief for bad things that go on and bad forms of management, frequently employees just quit and leave. It has one of the highest turnover rates of any government agency, but yet these folks are one of the very first lines of defense for this entire country. They are the ones that screen every passenger nationwide and everyone entering an airport that would have access to airplanes. And we have seen the devastation that an airplane into the hands of a wrong person can create in this country. And so these people are very, very important people with a very, very strong national security job.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox about the TSA campaign. J. David, once the election's over, what's the first order of business?
The first order of business is to sit down to immediately work out grievance procedures and some of the very basic work rules and trying to move forward with a contract. We want to get some basic outline of work rules so that there starts to be a level playing field for the employees in TSA and that everyone is being treated with the same work rules. We'll create a large bargaining team from TSOs around the country, trying to get everyone's input. Eventually, that'll narrow down to a smaller group of people that will go to the table bargaining a contract with the agency. We will certainly begin working on much stronger legislative type issues that's going to have to be dealt with in Congress concerning some of the pay and the benefits. And obviously, the employees just went through the PASS evaluation system. We want to annihilate PASS and have some form of new system in play before the next evaluation period.
Talk to us about AFGE's unique bottom-up approach with its members and activists.
AFGE, and I laugh about it very frequently, we are the most democratic union in the entire country, if not the entire world. Our unions, our local unions, have a lot of autonomy. We are not driven from the top down. We are driven from the bottom up. Our locals make decisions about running their locals and their day-to-day operations. That comes up through councils, through districts, to the national organization. There is a lot of autonomy, so it's very, very important. In agencies like TSA, Bureau of Prisons, VA, Border Patrol, any of our agencies like that, there's a process where there's a survey conducted of all the rank and file, receiving input. What do they want in a contract? How do they want that contract that moves on up to higher levels? And everyone has their input. We create web interaction type programs to receive the input. There's regular updates from bargaining teams. So it works. We are very much driven from the bottom.
Talk about the difference between when the agency was first created under President Bush and now operating under President Obama, the differences in the transitions that you've seen along the way.
We have, well, obviously the biggest transition is now they are given collective bargaining, which is a very large transition. There has been some, this administration has heard some of our concerns over the turnover and the treatment of employees. There have been some very bad managers that the agency has reacted to and dealt with. I mean, one of the things that we found in TSA is that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And when you have management and there is no checks and balances placed upon them, and they believe they get to do what they want, how they want, when they want, the way they want, and if you don't like it, just get out. That's not the real world. Unions create a balance in the workplace. It creates a mechanism for employees to surface concerns, have a grievance procedure to resolve issues. There is nothing wrong with having grievances. That's a normal thing. People have those in their everyday lives with their families and interactions. It's a grievance just means a complaint, and there's a way to resolve it. There's a way to sit down and come to an agreement on work rules, and then that everyone is treated the same way with those work rules. Very important.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox. J. David, we were talking extensively about TSA and the TSA campaign that AFGE is currently in. Talk about the importance of the grassroots members, AFGE TSOs around the country, getting up and getting the vote out.
Jason, I can't stress that enough. This election rests within the hands of the TSOs, the Transportation Security Officers themselves. They must take the time to vote. It's a simple process. They can do it over the telephone. They can do it over the internet. Everyone that I have talked to, which is thousands of officers, say that it takes less than a minute to do it. If they have not received their voting information, they need to call the 800 number immediately that's available in every airport and work site, even though it is getting at the wire. Today is Friday. This election ends on Tuesday night. So if someone does not have voting information, they need to call immediately, and it's going to be very difficult to get it. But I'd encourage people, exercise that right. I would encourage every one of our activists and officers out there, go and find two people that have not voted and get those people to vote. And you may laugh, you may say, well, that's only two people. That's really not going to matter in thousands of votes. But if all of our activists are getting two people to vote at 480 airports, that does amount to a lot of votes. And it's very, very important that our people exercise that right to vote.
And this goes for AFGE members or not, correct? Just because
correct.
You're an AFGE member doesn't mean that you have somehow been proxied in by
no,
a vote.
You must vote. And I'm glad you said that, Jason. Let's say that over and over again. You must vote. Being an AFGE member does not automatically mean you are voted yes for AFGE. If you do not exercise that right, call the number, put in your pen and vote, your vote does not get counted. Being a member does not automatically translate that you have voted. And that is a misnomer out there, and we certainly want to dispel that and stress over and over it is time to vote. And to all of our other AFG members, we have members in lots of other agencies who know many of the TSOs. Encourage them to exercise that right and vote.
Speaking of other agencies, you obviously have a strong interest in the VA and testified last week in front of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Tell us about your testimony.
Yes, Jason, I was testifying on S-572, which is a bill that deals with collective bargaining. The basic gist of the legislation is that VA will live by its own regulations. Currently, with Title 38 medical professionals, which is physicians, registered nurses, physician assistants, and a few other employees that fall into that category, the VA has work rules that says they will pay them X number of dollars. If the VA doesn't pay the employees properly, if the employees grieve, the VA says, yeah, we acknowledge we didn't pay you properly. However, our resolvement is we're not going to pay you properly because the law says that's barred from you grieving and seeking a resolution. It's a twirk in the law that's been used against the employees to the VA's advantage. The VA has agreed that they should pay people properly. We thought they were in agreement to this legislation. However, they again said that they opposed the legislation. I commend Senator Sherrod Brown, who introduced the legislation, spoke very strongly last Wednesday about the rights of employees to have collective bargaining, and the way to seek resolution of problems was through collective bargaining. And in today's world, while everyone is trashing and burning federal employees and collective bargaining, AFG applauds Senator Brown and the stand that he has taken, and many of the other members of Congress. We believe that this legislation will get voted out of committee at the end of the month, and we're looking forward to good things to coming with it.
So the VA recognizes that there is a problem with the fair treatment and pay of its employees. However, they're in opposition of legislation to fix it?
That's what it appears to be at this time. It strikes me strange, and many of the senators from the majority and the minority party, both was asked in questions, you mean VA sets rules that they get total control of setting the rules, but then they choose not to live by the rules that they get to make? And that was yes. And even to the VA, they pretty much had responded, yes, that's true. But if you get to make the rules, why don't you make rules that you can live by? And then why would you be upset when someone holds you accountable for living by the rules that you set? This is one of those I would like my cake and eat it too.
And Secretary Shinseki, does he support you on this?
Well, he has proclaimed support, except the careerist in the agency keeps stepping forward and saying no. So we shall see where this process goes. We had a very, very strong commitment from candidate Obama, who's now President Obama, that this situation should be fixed, and we are going to continue to hold the White House and the department accountable to fix this very, very bad piece of legislation, or this twerk in the law, where employees are not paid properly.
How did the Senate committee respond to your testimony? Were they aware ahead of time that this was an issue?
There were several that were aware of it. There were some that were not. Chairman Murray seemed very receptive to the process, and so we are looking forward to further review, and we do believe that there is a good chance this will be voted out of committee, and that will give us a chance to move it into legislation. It was voted out of committee last year in the Congress, but then no legislation moved through the Congress in the waning days of Congress. So this time it's a chance to move it out early and to get the legislation moving. There is companion legislation in the House that Congressman Filner has introduced.
In addition to Congressman Filner or Senators Murray and Brown, Are you finding more support gathering on Capitol Hill around this issue?
Yes, we are. My Senator, Barbara Mikulski, has supported the legislation. We've got a fair number of senators that supported Senator Begich from Alaska. I don't have the list in front of me, but it's steadily growing. Al Franken from Minnesota. There's members of the committee and those that are not on the committee that has supported the legislation, and we do feel that it is picking up momentum and beginning to move.
So we're facing issues not only in the Veterans Administration, but also obviously TSA around the issue of collective bargaining rights. And there's been such an attack on public workers and their right to collectively bargain. Talk about how that impacts a worker.
Jason, it impacts workers in many ways. I mean, I don't understand leaders in government as well as the American public that believe pensions are wrong and that having health care is wrong. And our problem is there are no jobs. When people are unemployed and there's no jobs, people are saying, well, I don't have this, why should you? We don't need to get into the race to the bottom. We all need to be racing to the top. The American dream has changed. It's now, let's all try to see how fast we can get to the bottom, not how we get to the top. How can you be opposed to paying a school teacher, providing a pension for a school teacher? I look at my own life. Some of the greatest people that I know were school teachers that taught me. I owe them everything about my life. They taught me how to read, how to write, how to do math, how to have success in my life. How can you just be against school teachers? School teachers are not public enemy number one. They are great people. I'm standing in amazement nowadays as I see these type things going on. Many good teachers are quitting, retiring, leaving, and it's going to be very difficult to get people to fill those positions. And it's not just teachers. I mean, firemen, police officers, the list goes on and on and on.
Do you find the times that we're living in to be a good example of why unions are needed?
Unions are needed more than ever. Unions can help create jobs. Unions help create good jobs. The profits in this country are going out the roof. You know, you look at corporate profits, you look at productivity, you look at all these things that's going on in this country, but yet wages and benefits keep being suppressed and keep being pushed down. I'm of a personal opinion that we are seeing an annihilation of the middle class in this country, and I have very, very strong feelings. If you have a strong middle class, money goes up and it goes down. If you just have the money going to the upper class, very little of it comes down. I mean, we're back to those philosophies of the type jobs you create. Henry Ford wanted every employee that he had to be able to buy an automobile. Nowadays, it's, you know, we want to be very elite, and we don't want people to be able to buy and to have.
You mentioned a feeling amongst people that it was almost a race to the bottom. What do you think it will take to change that feeling and to get people going back up in the right direction again?
Jobs. If we had jobs in this country and the unemployment was down, you would not hear all these issues and all these concerns, because number one, people would have jobs. They would be making a living. There would be competition for jobs. Employers would be having to increase wages and benefits to continue to attract the best and the brightest, those type things. And that's what really concerns me. We talk about with the federal government, state governments, local governments, abolishing pensions, abolishing health care, abolishing all these type things. Then every word I hear is we want to attract the best and the brightest. Well, AFG is an employer. We can't attract the best and the brightest if we say we're paying minimum wage and no benefits. I mean, we would not get people applying for jobs.
J. David Cox, AFGE National Secretary Treasurer, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jason. Glad to be with you.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand. at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll discuss the House's proposed spending caps with Economic Policy Institute Federal Budget Policy Analyst Andrew Fieldhouse.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Did you know MetLife Auto and Home has valuable deals on insurance for AFGE members that could save them hundreds every year? Benefits include special discounts just for being an AFGE member, and in most states, a deductible credit for claim-free driving up to $250. Call the AFGE Benefits line at 1-888-844-2343 today to see how much you could save. That's 1-888-844-2343. Underwritten by Metropolitan Group Property and Casualty Insurance Company, Warwick, Rhode Island.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Andrew Fieldhouse, Federal Budget Policy Analyst for the Economic Policy Institute. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Jason.
The House Judiciary Committee marked up a bill proposing a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Tell us about that.
The House Judiciary Committee is working on a balanced budget amendment that would limit non-interest spending to 18% of the economy. It's largely similar to a Senate balanced budget amendment that's worked its way through and has the endorsement of most of Republican Senate leadership. The formula for how spending would be limited is different, but it does several things. It would require supermajority votes in both chambers of Congress in order to do a number of things, notably to run a budget deficit. It would also require supermajority votes to ever increase taxes, making it much easier to cut taxes than to allow them to rise back up. This is problematic for two reasons. One is bad economics. It constrains fiscal policy and exacerbates economic downturns by requiring supermajority votes to run budget deficits. A budget deficit is a good thing during an economic downturn because the government is absorbing a shock to the private sector, sort of making up for lost private sector demand. It's instructive that neither the Recovery Act nor the Economic Stabilization Act, which created the Troubled Asset Relief Program to stabilize the financial sector, would have met this supermajority threshold in both houses. The second reason it's bad is it's a bad policy rationale. We have a jobs crisis at hand. We have long-term budget challenges, but we don't have an immediate spending crisis. And this effort to really constrain spending to a small share of the economy is an underlying theme through a number of bills and budgetary proposals that have been working through both houses, both chambers of Congress.
Andrew,
yeah.
Oh, has this ever been done before?
In 1997, a balanced budget amendment almost passed. It was defeated by a single vote in the Senate. Many states have balanced budget amendments, but this is a little different. The federal budget operates on a fundamentally different level than either state budgets or even household budgets. The federal government's the only economic actor with access to international credit markets, and it sort of acts as the lender of last resort for the U.S. economy. So when economic activity starts to dive, as it did in 2008 and 2009, you want the federal government to be there as a backstop to economic demand, to aggregate demand. If you had enacted a balanced budget amendment in the 1990s, it's unlikely that we would have been able to prop up the economy in mid-2009 the way we did. If you look at the Recovery Act, the 2009 stimulus bill, when money started to flow out, that's really when the economy turned around. The economy bottomed out in mid-2009 as the Recovery Act was kicking in. You hear this disputed among policymakers, among politicians, but not among economists. Every economist will tell you that the Recovery Act was instrumental in ending the free fall that we had seen in late 2008, early 2009.
Andrew, explain to the audience what you mean when you said that a deficit is a good thing during the downturn.
Sure. understandably, there's a lot of anger about a $1 trillion deficit and high debt. And families have to balance their checkbooks. There's a lot of financial pressure out there and a lot of economic insecurity. And it's easy to confuse the federal government's checkbook with your own, but it's not a fair comparison. They're in no way the same. It's not advantageous necessarily to be running a budget deficit during good economic times. We've been running deficits for a decade throughout the Bush administration. After the Clinton surpluses were squandered, we ran chronic budget deficits even while the economy was expanding. But when the economy slips into recession, you have two things happen. You have a decrease in revenue. Right? As workers lose their jobs, they stop paying taxes. It's pretty simple. Businesses go out of business or aren't making profits. They stop paying taxes. So revenue falls. You also have spending automatically increase. We have what are called automatic stabilizers in the federal budget. Programs like food stamps are means tested. But as poverty rises, as unemployment rises, the number of eligible participants increases. So we spend more money on food stamps, unemployment insurance, even the federal formula for sharing Medicaid costs with the states provides more relief to state budgets when we hit periods of economic downturn. So automatically, even before the Recovery Act, spending increased. That's a good thing. Programs like unemployment insurance have a very high return, close to $1.70 in economic activity is generated for every dollar the federal government spends on unemployment insurance, which makes sense. If you all of a sudden lose your paycheck, you don't have any disposable income, and the federal government writes you an unemployment insurance check, you immediately spend it. There's no margin for saving. So it goes straight to consumption, and because it's recycled into the economy very quickly, it generates a lot of economic activity. Some proposals, like say an estate tax cut, doesn't generate any near-term spending. It just generates savings. That's an example of totally ineffective economic stimulus. But these programs, the direct spending in the Recovery Act, sort of infrastructure projects, aid to states, have widely been agreed to have generated between 3 and 4 million jobs over the last few years. Hugely important in ending the recession.
Andrew, would this balanced budget amendment force more action in Washington, or would it contribute to further political gridlock?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it would contribute further to political gridlock. If the objective really is bringing government spending down to 18% of GDP, it's going to be incredibly difficult to do that. Using historical averages to guide current policy is a terrible idea. The population is aging and medical costs are growing faster than the economy as a whole. We are paying off interest on a decade's worth of deficit finance tax cuts and foreign wars, and we're also coming out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. For these reasons, government expenditure needs to be higher than it has been in recent decades. If you ignore all of those economic realities and say, no, we're going to constrain government to a very low level, in my opinion, an implausibly low level, then you have a very hard fight about what gets cut. If you look at the House Republican budget, for instance, the Defense Department doesn't get cut. But it's very hard to want to cut Medicaid by $1.4 trillion over the next decade while increasing defense spending. A lot of liberals would absolutely reject that on face value. If you demand shared pain, you shouldn't have a disproportionate burden of deficit reduction on low-income families. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities estimated that roughly two-thirds of the spending cuts in the House Republican budget would hit low-income families. So you would have a very nasty battle about what gets cut.
How would this budget amendment impact the government's ability to respond to emergency situations or, as we talked about, an economic downturn like in 2009?
It would make it much harder to respond to either. In terms of scale, an economic downturn probably requires much more spending than an emergency would. But even something like the flooding we're seeing in the West right now would be constrained if we were running a budget just a perfectly balanced budget. On the margin, it could be very hard to even find $10 billion in disaster relief. Normally, disaster relief is designated emergency money. It circumvents PAYGO. That wouldn't work anymore if you had a strict balanced budget amendment. You need either 60 or 67 senators and 60% or two-thirds of House members to approve any deficit finance spending, which would be very difficult. And in terms of economic crises, it would all but rule out balanced, effective stimulus. We've seen recently such a high degree of polarization in Washington that any economic stimulus other than tax stimulus is pretty much dead on arrival. The Republicans are more willing to accept tax cuts because this gets into shrinking government as a share of the economy, but totally unwilling to compromise on spending increases. Why we haven't seen any job creation legislation come out of the 112th Congress. But that's problematic because direct spending is absolutely more effective at creating jobs and cutting taxes. If you have a demand problem, if private sector demand slumps, cutting taxes allows someone to save money, as I explained earlier. The more that's saved, the less goes in the economy, the less effective it is at creating jobs. Direct spending on infrastructure, you put people to work building something, you put people to work building supplies for construction projects. That's very effective. There's no margin for saving. It just gets recycled into the economy. So you'd cut off both your options for how to stimulate the economy and likely just rule out fiscal stimulus entirely. The lack of a counterfactual over the last 3 years, I think, has been really problematic. We can't see just how bad it would have been without the Recovery Act, but it could have been really bad. Alan Blinder and Mark Zandi, two economists, sort of tried to figure out what the recession would have looked like without the extraordinary measures taken by the Federal Reserve and Congress. If we hadn't done anything, you'd see unemployment closer to 11%. Prices would have been falling outright. We would have been in a mild depression, at least.
Andrew, my last question for you is the best way to grow the economy and create jobs, and what types of jobs should be created?
Well, right now, job creation absolutely has to be the top priority. We still face a crisis in the labor market. Unemployment's above 9%, and it's going to be years and years before we return to full employment, which is really unnecessary, but very problematic for the economy. There are going to be long-lasting scarring effects. And as long as unemployment is high, it's going to be very hard to reduce the budget deficit. From my perspective, it makes sense. Create jobs first, put people back to work, then address the structural budget deficits that are hiding underneath the cyclical budget deficit. The best ways to do that, what I've been talking about, direct spending on infrastructure, on transportation. Interest rates, long-term interest rates, are at historically low levels. It's a very cheap time for the federal government to borrow, and we have a huge need to invest in our infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers rates our infrastructure a D letter grade. We need $2.2 trillion worth of investment over the next 5 years. So a new surface transportation reauthorization bill would help. The Obama administration proposed a six-year surface transportation reauthorization bill that would increase spending by a little over $200 billion over the next decade. That would be a good first step. More aid to the states would be very helpful. Come July, the states are going to run out of the higher Medicaid matching rate that's been extended from the Recovery Act. You're going to see much more pressure on state budgets this year than we did last year because the Recovery Act money has pretty much disappeared. An extension of unemployment insurance benefits beyond calendar year 2011 would be very helpful to keep paychecks and to keep money going through the economy and keep consumption up. And there's also a do-no-harm component to all of this, proposals to immediately slash federal spending by $100 to $300 to $500 billion, which we've seen out there, would all turn the dial on unemployment the wrong direction. The Republican Study Committee just put out a proposal to have next year's budget deficit entirely by cutting spending. A wide range of economists agree and that would probably create a spark a double dip recession. That's the worst thing you could do for jobs or for the deficit. So don't cut spending yet. Try and help the states out a little bit more so they don't lay off as many cops, don't lay off as many teachers. Also, try and put people back to work directly. And then there are some other things you could do. You could do youth summer jobs programs. So there are a lot of programs you could do. But I think aid to states and direct spending on infrastructure are probably the most effective at this point.
Andrew Fieldhouse, federal budget policy analyst with the Economic Policy Institute. Andrew, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me on.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about campaign finance reform with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees. Looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Bob Edgar, President and CEO of Common Cause and also former Congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back with you.
Now, a big issue these days for Common Cause is campaign finance reform. Tell us about this.
We work very hard on trying to control money in politics. We feel as though we're the Don Quixotes of good government. Over the last couple of years, we've installed public financing in places like Arizona and Connecticut and Maine, and is working great at the state level. Unfortunately, we've not been able to convince the House and Senate that they need to control the influence of special interest money and support something called the Fair Elections Now bill that's been introduced in both the House and the Senate. We're working hard to change people's minds, especially since the Citizens United case came down from the Supreme Court a year and a half ago. Under that decision, which basically gave corporations the ability to dip into their corporate treasury and spend that on political campaigns, money is simply flowing into politics at such a rate that many members of Congress are representing special interests more than they're representing the public's interest. So Common Cause is redoubling our efforts to control money in politics and working at both the state and the national level to see if we can't install a voluntary public financing system.
Congressman, you indicated that states such as Arizona, Connecticut, and Maine have gotten on board with this idea, but why haven't the House and the Senate jumped on as well? What's the holdup?
Well, I think incumbents learn how to raise money, and they spend about 20 hours a week dialing for dollars. Incumbents seem to know how to get the $1.2 million that they need in the House and the many millions of dollars they need in the Senate to run for reelection. And so it's hard to convince them, although last year we were able to get as many as 165 House members to co-sponsor the Fair Elections Now bill. We didn't have sufficient co-sponsors to get a vote, even when progressives or Democrats were in charge of the House of Representatives. We're going to continue to work at it. At the state level, there's an interesting example in Connecticut. In the 08 election, 74% of the candidates running for state legislative offices used our voluntary public financing system. 81% got elected. And just in the last few weeks, the media has covered the fact that Connecticut has been one of the best legislatures in memory, not just for Connecticut, but across the country, of Democrats, Republicans, and independents who took no special interest money working collaboratively on issues. When I served in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, after getting elected, often worked closer on ideology and on issues of common interest than they did on partisan issues. The partisanship has gotten out of hand, and the special interest involvement has gotten out of hand.
If we were to change the way money influences politics, how do you think that would change the political process?
Well, Exxon and BP and all the other oil companies would have less sway and less influence, and perhaps we'd move more quickly to a national energy policy that was based on renewable energy as opposed to an oil-based economy. I think in the healthcare debate, I think we would have had a much more open conversation, including things like single payer and other important reforms that should have been considered by the House and Senate, rather than letting the pharmaceutical companies and the hospitals and the medical industry dictate the outcome of healthcare reform. The bottom line is, looking forward, if we're going to solve problems like global warming, if we're going to solve problems like public education, if we're going to solve problems like healthcare, and if we're going to solve problems like the infrastructure needs in terms of jobs, we're going to have elected officials who listen to lobbyists and special interests, but aren't swayed simply because those special interests are piling in millions and millions of dollars of campaign contributions. When I served in Congress, the special interests put money into politics through political action committees, but their first interest was trying to convince congressmen and senators to vote the right way based on talking points. In recent memory, the talking points are far less important. More important to those special interests are how many dollars they can get to members of Congress as quickly as possible so that the oil companies and the coal companies and the gas companies and the special interests can control the outcome. Common Cause just worked recently to shine a big light on Charles and David Koch, the Koch brothers, who together have $44 billion of personal wealth. And they're spending that personal wealth as the owners of one of the largest private companies in the country to dictate what the Energy and Commerce Committee does in relationship to regulations of EPA. They're trying to dictate what states are doing. They were heavily involved in the Governor Walker issue out in Wisconsin. And when you have the kind of billions of dollars that these two Koch brothers have, and you spend that to manipulate public opinion and elected office, we're quickly moving to a very dangerous moment. My friend Bill Moyer says this is the most dangerous moment in American history when it comes to democracy. We're either going to be a nation of and by and for the people, or of and by and for corporations. And we're quickly seeing that corporations, particularly the bad rogue corporations, are buying their way into local government, state government, and national government. And Common Cause believes that we need to go back and recover some of the passion of our early founders who thought that the people ought to rule rather than corporations.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're speaking with Common Cause President and CEO Bob Edgar about the influence of money in politics. Congressman, as we look ahead to 2012 and the elections that we'll face, how do you think the influence of money in politics will impact that situation?
We're going to see an exponential increase in the amount of money being spent. Already, because of Citizens United, the incumbent president, Obama, has decided he's going to forestall any reform of presidential public financing and try to raise $1 billion. And that means, on the other side, there'll be some of these corporate and wealthy actors who can put $1 billion on the table on day one in support of their favorite candidate. So you're going to see at the presidential level and the House and Senate level an unprecedented amount of money pouring into the system. And the bottom line is we need elected officials to serve the public interest. Most Americans think when they go to the polls to vote, they're voting for people that will represent them, represent their thinking, or at least be honest and evaluate the issues based on merit. That's simply not going to be the case if we allow money to corrode and erode the current system.
I can't imagine that the day and age that we live in now is exactly what the founding fathers had in mind when the political system was created.
Well, I think that's exactly right. Last week, we had a demonstration in Pittsburgh at the shareholder meeting for Target Company. As a result of the Citizens United case, Target was able to use corporate treasury money to support a candidate and a candidate's campaign in Minnesota. that was far, far to the right. And many of the shareholders of Target came and demonstrated in Pittsburgh and tried to take back the power that these corporations are using to exploit the Citizens United case and under the guise of being involved politically, put that money behind candidates that hold positions that are counter to the positions of average ordinary voters. Common Cause is going to continue to call out corporations that pay little or no taxes, who use their corporate treasuries politically, and who try to get around any form of disclosure. Currently under the law, for example, if you get a big federal contract in the defense industry, you can take some of that money, turn it around, and spend it against those elected officials who don't support a particular defense item, or they can spend it in favor of those elected officials or challengers who are going to support their special interest. It's simply outrageous. It's got to be changed. We need full disclosure, and we need to shine a bright light on all of these wealthy persons and corporations that are hiding and do not want full transparency of the resource. And we really have to get public officials who can get elected without spending 40, 50, 60% of their legislative time raising money for reelection.
Earlier, we talked a little bit about the 2012 presidential election. This week, the Republican field held a debate. What are your thoughts so far in this early going of it?
Well, it seems to me that the Republicans are having a hard time figuring out what candidate represents the core message of the Republican Party. When I served in Congress, some of my best friends were moderate Republicans along the line of Eisenhower, Lincoln, and Rockefeller. You see very few of them now, and you see a lot of individuals who are either one-issue Republicans or Republicans that are so far to the right that they're not willing to compromise and work with anyone from the middle and left. My hope is that through the debate process that began last night, that the Republican community will stand up and find more candidates who might represent the moderate middle and have those persons run in opposition to the current incumbent president. I don't think this is a time for the Tea Party or for ultra-radical conservatives to rule the country. We tried that under President Bush, and you know, it's strange for me to see all of these conservative Republicans wringing their hands about the deficit and debt. They weren't thinking very clearly about that when they were voting for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan without raising revenues to pay for them.
Congressman, our final question for you is, how do we make voting easier for Americans and encourage more participation in the political process?
Well, first, we have to stop some of the state legislators who have gotten elected this past November who are trying to suppress the vote. There's some tragic things happening in Maine, in Wisconsin, and in many states where they're trying to take people off the voting rolls. But we need to encourage 80, 90% of our people to vote rather than 45 or 50% in a good election. And that means we need same-day registration. We need to make sure the voting machines work so that if there's a close election, the results can be analyzed and audited, and we have confidence that the person who has the most votes actually got the most votes. Some of these more complicated computerized machines that do not have a paper trail need to be replaced. And we also need to make sure that registration is far easier. You ought to be able to have everyone registered at birth to vote, and at age 18, give them the same ceremony that we give to immigrants and help them realize how important voting is and make sure that when they vote, their vote counts and that the people elected really serve their interest.
Common Cause President and CEO Bob Edgar, thank you so much for your time today.
It's great to be with you, and best wishes to you and your work.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE National Secretary Treasurer J. David Cox, Economic Policy Institute, Federal Budget Policy.